We'll do that Friday thing, because, you know, Friday. We'll talk about a couple other stories in the news, of course, and then we'll have a little snack on the way out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today. This one is, I believe, August the 19th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so look, no dilly-dallying, no throat clearing, no long, bloated wind-up. Just the last 5 days in this economy and a very specific day next week in about the next 7 minutes or so. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Brian Chung is at Yahoo Finance. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, guys.
So, Kate, let me get to you, and I want to point out, as everybody has seen the news, I'm sure, that the president signed the Inflation Reduction Act this week, and I want to ask your sense of the Biden administration's plan, right, when it came into office, was to fundamentally expand the role of government in this economy. We talked about that a lot a year and a half, 2 years ago. This is sort of delivering on that promise, right? He is injecting now the government into this economy in a substantial way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so hard because the original plan that the president talked about on the campaign trail and the big, really ambitious, I mean, they had to break it into two parts, if you remember, the families plan and the jobs plan. Huge amount of, an overhaul and revamp in so many areas, child care, you know, family paid leave, health care, climate. And so if you, you know, compare it to that, it feels, you know, greatly slims down. I mean, they're not doing all that they wanted to do. But right, if you step back and think about it, it is a very big deal. It is introducing some really big changes into the economy. So I definitely think it's safe to say that, they are delivering on a really big chunk of that promise. And I think, in talking last year to economists and folks, I mean, I'm thinking of Janet Yellen, too, and sure. I always talked about this. I mean, climate is so important to them. I think that it was viewed as really substantial. They're disappointed about some of the family components that they couldn't get done, but it's a really big deal.
Brian, this was, it used to be Build Back Better, then it became Build Back Mansion after Senator Joe Manchin trying to make him happy, and now it is the Inflation Reduction Act. I'm obliged by the laws of, I don't know, fact, to point out that this Act doesn't really reduce inflation all that much.
Well, not in the immediate term, at least. I mean, there's some tax credits for energy-related home improvements. You've got a little bit of EV tax credits for those wanting to buy a Tesla, healthcare changes, oil drilling provisions. But a lot of these types of things are going to take many, many years to kick in. And there are actually dates by which we shouldn't even expect to see any of that bleed through. But the idea is that overall, it should improve the nation's infrastructure so that, for example, energy isn't as expensive as it is right now. We know how reliant we were on foreign oil, which was a big reason why the whole high oil prices that we experienced a few months ago earlier in the summer were such a big story that weighed on the American political view of how our economy was operating. So again, those are things that won't be bleeding through from the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, for many years. So that's something that won't do anything for that 8.5% year-over-year inflation we saw in the month of July. But again, the Biden administration holding their breath that, hey, we can take this to the bank and say over the long term, we can make our economy a little bit more independent in a way that actually would help us with inflation in the long run.
Hey, Kate, can you riff for a minute on something you had in Morning Money on Politico today about deficit reduction and how important that is to this package and why there is some concern about whether or not the Biden administration might backslide a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about this is, boy, like deficit reduction is really having a moment. There are a few years there, certainly in the Trump administration, yeah. And then maybe even at the beginning of the Biden administration, where there is a shifting view among economists that we don't need to worry so much about deficits. Clearly, that's shifted a lot, and it has a lot to do with inflation. And the concern that, you know, we heard Senator Manchin express a number of times is we're spending so much, we're borrowing, we're adding to, you know, right. Deficits are going up, we're adding to the debt, that's fueling inflation. So they, you know, made sure to include some deficit reduction in this package, and it's pretty good. And you've seen groups like the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, Fiscal Hawks, they've endorsed this. They think it's great, but they're worried that there were some last minute changes. Not, you know, nothing nefarious, just kind of procedural hurdles. They had to make a couple tweaks to the bill at the last minute that this group says would maybe not, you know, would take away some of the sort of deficit reduction power, and they're worried that that could maybe. It just wouldn't have as big of an effect on inflation, even if, as you pointed out, it's fairly small. They're calling for the Biden administration to kind of hold the line, make sure that the bill includes as much, or the law rather, includes as much deficit reduction as possible. And they're a little worried about student debt too, which we can get into, and the effects that would have on deficits and inflation.
Yeah. Okay. So Brian, I'm gonna posit something here, and then I want your reaction, and then Kate, you get the second bite at this apple. Look around for a minute. Oil is down. Lumber is down. Housing is down. Egg prices are down. Used car prices are down, for crying out loud. We have passed peak inflation. It's all sunshine and light from here, inflation-wise. Discuss.
Well, let's wait for a few more inflation reports to see if that bears out, Kai. But, I mean, yeah, certainly. Look, if you take a look at that July CPI report, which, you know, you've discussed at length on the programming before, which came out some time ago, I mean, it did show between the months of June and July – you know, no substantial increase. It was essentially unchanged, you know, prices between those 2 months. So, you know, that is exactly what Jay Powell has said in the past, the Fed chairman, when he said that, well, inflationary numbers need to plateau before they eventually go down. And we've seen the plateau. We haven't seen the come down yet. But yes, the oil prices, having continued their declines over the course of the beginning of August, should point to another positive inflation report where maybe we will see further declines happening in other broad-based categories as well. But look, at the end of the day, this doesn't change the picture for policymakers. Inflation at an 8.5% level, that's higher than it was last year, still much too high and above the Fed's 2% target. So look, those interest rates are going to continue.
Kate, real quick, what do you think about my peak inflation is in the rearview mirror theory?
Oh, man, I would never say that. I think there are many people smarter than me who felt really burned last year. You remember, we had this conversation just about a year ago. And, you know, I think, there's so many encouraging signs. You know, it's really tempting to declare that. But I do think, you know, Jay Powell, for certain, and his colleagues at the Fed, they want to wait. Right. They're going to take it slow. They want to see a lot of evidence that, you know, as Brian said, some more positive reports before they make that declaration.
All right. Super quick, just to deliver on the setup here. Jay Powell gives a speech at Jackson Hole, the big Fed retreat next Friday. What's he going to say, Brian? Give me like the 15-second version.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine he's going to get offered. He's going to offer some update on how he sees the economy unfolding. Obviously, since the last Fed meeting at the end of July, there's been that updated inflation report. We've gotten a few more anecdotes in terms of how manufacturing and retail sales and other things have developed in the economy. And Bank of America, at least saying in their preview and what they expect, they think that he's going to say that the pace of hikes at some point is going to slow, perhaps teeing up a smaller comparatively rate hike in the Fed's next meeting in September of half a percentage point instead of the 0.75% that they had been delivering in the last two meetings. But we'll have to see. That'll be at 10 a.m. Eastern on Friday.
We will be talking about it next week. Kate, super quick, what do you think he's going to say? Basically what Brian laid out?
We're going to keep raising rates.
Yeah.
That's what he's going to say. And I don't know how much more specific he'll be, but definitely rates are still going up. And when they get up, he's probably going to say that they're going to stay there for a while.
Kate Davidson.
I don't think that they're good. Sorry.
No, that's all right. We're getting squeezed. Kate Davidson at Politico and Brian Chung at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
All right. We'll see you. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I mean, you know, it's been better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the understanding that correlation is not causality, here are two things that happened today. No, wait, actually three now that I think about it. Thing one is that General Motors said this morning that it's bringing back its quarterly dividend after suspending it early in the pandemic to hang on to its cash. Thing number two is that the company is also going to bump up what it calls opportunistic share repurchases. That is them, not me saying that. Buying back as much as $5 billion worth of their own stock. Oh, and thing three is that GM shares popped a bit more than 2.5% today on that news. Corporate share buybacks do not have the best of reputations. As we know, Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains why we love to hate them.
When companies have cash to spare, buying back shares is one way executives can reward shareholders. It's a move that can boost the share price. But critics say there are better ways to spend that cash.
Every dollar that goes into share buybacks is a dollar that's taken away from something else.
Nico Luciani of the Roosevelt Institute says GM, for example, could use the $5 billion it's just set aside for buybacks to pay its workers more, reduce prices, or bolster key initiatives like a deeper push into electric vehicles.
That's $5 billion that could be going into really accelerating the pace of getting those EVs, their new EVs, out into the market.
The company is moving forward with its EV plans, says GM spokesman Jim Kane. Its first battery plant is set to open within days in Ohio, with more underway.
The investments have reached a critical mass and the earnings are so strong, it means there is capital we can return to shareholders while keeping all our other investments on track.
Buybacks may not be popular with everyone, but Charles Elson of the University of Delaware says they're a critical tool.
If you don't return money to the investor, then no one's going to invest, and then you're not going to have any sort of business going forward, or the products that you produce won't be produced.
One other critique is that executives use buybacks to juice a company's stock price, often right around the time earnings season rolls around. Alice Boname of the University of Arizona says there's one other thing to keep in mind.
There's this idea that, you know, I reduce the number of shares and bing, my stock price is going to go up, but the value of the firm has also gone down.
GM didn't say in its announcement what the timeline for its buyback program will look like. The newly passed Inflation Reduction Act includes a 1% tax on stock buybacks that kicks in next year. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
You know that phrase, think globally, act locally? It applies entrepreneurially, too. Here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Francisca Troutman. I'm based in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Glass Half Full. Like most good ideas, it sort of started over a bottle of wine that my co-founder and I were sharing one night. This was something we did pretty regularly during our senior year of college. And we just sort of sat with like that bottle a little more, and we knew it would end up in a landfill where it would never decompose, it would never do any good. And so we sort of hatched this plan to change that. Expectations were very different from reality. We thought it was going to be this small pet project. I mean, obviously we chose a backyard as the first place to operate this program. And suddenly the glass just started coming, and it truly has not stopped since. So we had set up these little barrels to collect glass, and literally within hours, they would be completely full of glass and we would have to go around and replace them. And then suddenly there was nowhere else to put the glass and we had to crush through it. And it's been sort of a blessing and a curse. We collect glass in two different ways. One is through our free drop-off program, and then our paid pickup services for residents, as well as businesses like restaurants, bars, hotels, casinos. And then once that glass reaches our facility, we will put it in what we call Glass Mountain and then load it into our hopper of our pulverizing system. What we get is a glass sand product, and then we sift that into different sizes. And each size that we create is used for something unique. So the very fine sand is really good for sandbags for disaster relief and flooding. The coarse sand is what we're using for coastal restoration projects and protection projects. And then the larger sizes that are more like a gravel are good for flooring, decoration, and art. I think the downfall of a lot of business owners is that you never feel like you have made it. I think a lot of founders feel this way. You know, you reach a certain goalpost that you'd set for yourself, but you've already created another goalpost that you're setting. So I definitely remember specific times like when we started our glass recycling program and we already had 100 people on the waiting list to get their glass picked up. And when we calculated, you know, oh, 100 people times like $25 a month, that's $2,500 a month in monthly recurring revenue. Like, we're becoming legit. But then again, we were like, okay, when do we get to $500,000 in yearly recurring revenue? When do we get to a million? Like, and so constantly like moving that goalpost is something that we're always doing.
Recurring revenue, that's the name of the game. Franziska Trautman collecting all those glass bottles there at Glass Half Full down in New Orleans. We cannot do this series without you, right? So please let us know how things are going for you. You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
You could have a black pepper spoon with your macaroni and cheese or your pasta.
But do I want that? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 292 today, 0.8%, finished at 33,706. The NASDAQ cut 260 points, that's 2%, 12,705. The S&P 500 subtracted 55 points, 1.2%, 42.28. For the week, the Dow fell 0.2%, the NASDAQ down 2.6%, the S&P 500 down 1.2%, actually. Gas prices, talked about that, falling in that question to Brian and Kate. Gas prices averaging $3.91 a gallon. That is down 6 cents from a week ago. The farming equipment company Deere reported higher than expected sales for the quarter. Still, the company missed expectations. We did a whole thing on expectations earlier this week. Deere harvested 0.4%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-notes up to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. None of us felt it when it happened, but there was something of a shift last month in how we get our content, video content in particular. Nielsen, the ratings people, said this week that back in July, for the first time, we spent more time streaming shows than watching shows on cable. Streaming is up 22% over the past year, cable down almost 9%. Part of what's going on, of course, is just the amount of content you can get only on streaming services. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, as streaming continues to grow, there are going to be some more challenges.
One obstacle for streaming companies is how to win over more customers, especially given how many people already subscribe to a streaming service. Hannah Avery is Consumer Insights Director at Kantar.
The streaming category is already at close to 90% penetration of U.S. households.
Consumers are also getting choosier about which services they want to spend money on. Mike Prue at Forrester says that's why companies have been bundling services together.
When you look at deals being made between Netflix and, let's say, Xfinity being bundled together in some cases, or Disney Plus coming with your Verizon.
Another obstacle for streaming companies is bandwidth. Craig Moffitt with the research company Moffitt Nathanson says if you're watching the Super Bowl on cable TV, it doesn't really matter whether another 100 people tune in.
With streaming, that's different. Each individual customer is creating their own stream. And so if you have 100 people watching the Super Bowl, it's 100 times more capacity required than if you have one person watching the Super Bowl.
Moffitt says that's a big issue in many rural parts of the country where internet service isn't all that great.
And the issue is not just that the individual consumer doesn't have sufficient bandwidth to be streaming regularly. It's that the communities themselves may not have sufficient bandwidth.
Moffitt says bigger telecom companies often don't have the incentive to upgrade bandwidth in rural areas. But Christopher Mitchell at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance says a lot of smaller and community-owned companies in more rural states have been stepping in.
One of the things we're seeing is that some of those states, like Mississippi and Arkansas and Missouri, they have been making historic investments through electric cooperatives.
And after the pandemic created even more demand for streaming, Mitchell says many of those upgrades have been expedited.
They did upgrades in 6 months that they'd been planning on doing in 18 months or 2 years.
As a result, Mitchell says people in rural areas will be able to binge more shows in a few years. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, more growth now, also infrastructure of a sort. According to Allied Market Research, which is, just like it sounds, a market research firm, the edible cutlery market is expected to be worth $56 million by 2026. Not a lot on the face of it, $56 million, but that would be an 11% annual growth rate in that category since 2019. Jennifer Kingston is chief correspondent at Axios. She wrote the other day about cutlery that you can eat. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Great to be here with you, Kai.
Describe for me, would you, the rabbit hole that you fell into that led you to write this piece.
I was reading a story in the New York Times about the top food trends for 2022.
Yeah.
The one that caught my eye was tasty tableware. The Times reported that prices are coming down for edible chopsticks, forks, spoons, straws. So I started calling the companies that that sell these to see what was going on with them.
Well, so we'll get to the prices thing in a second, because obviously cost is an issue here. But let me ask you this. First of all, have you tried these things?
I tried some edible straws. They taste a little bit like fortune cookies, perhaps, or wafers. The companies suggest creative pairings. You could have a black pepper spoon with your macaroni and cheese or your pasta.
All right. Okay. Well, you know, I will let the gourmands among our listeners figure that one out. But the reason I ask is because, for me anyway, there's a little bit of an ew factor that you have to get by, because I would worry about like sogginess and just a texture thing. But there's a very real business part of this thing, right? It's not cheap. You have to get consumers to adopt it. And as of right now, there's still a little bit, I gather, of an uphill climb.
Absolutely. And you're right on all these fronts. A few of these startup companies that are making this stuff have come and gone because they're a lot more expensive than the plastic or conventional alternatives. You can buy a whole bunch of paper or plastic straws for pennies, whereas these cost maybe 20 or 30 cents a piece on a good day. Now, a whole bunch of places are adopting them. Carnival Cruise Lines will put an edible straw in your drink, for example, and so forth. But either they are charging extra for them or they're raising the prices of the products that they come in. That said, people are really interested in being sustainable.
Right.
And one of the biggest marketing hooks for these products is that they are actually home compostable, which is the brass ring in this type of sustainability.
Right. And there are, you know, varying levels of environmental awareness and sustainability consciousness among the consuming public. And people who are going to buy these things and do it at home will certainly do it the proper way. But if I'm on a, you know, Carnival Cruise Line, that's not the first thing I'm thinking of. So if I don't eat it, it goes into the landfill, right?
It probably does. Yeah. One point that a lot of the manufacturers of these edible spoons, forks, straws, what have you, kept making to me is that things that we think are good, like paper straws, actually aren't. If a paper straw is used for anything but water, that it can't immediately be recycled without being rinsed. And in an era where governments and so forth are cutting back on single-use plastics, edible alternatives are seen as a kind of fun niche product that people can use as a novelty and feel good about.
Yeah, a novelty for now, but obviously it's kind of the way of the future as we all try to be more sustainable. Jennifer Kingston, she is the chief correspondent at Axios. Jennifer, thanks a bunch. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai. Now eat your vegetables and your plate too.
I will not. I will not. I'm not a vegetable guy. But anyway, that's a whole different podcast. All right. Thank you, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a note that I got after the show yesterday from Samuel Husky. He's a professor of classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma. Dear Kai, he wrote, I enjoy listening to your podcast, but I would like to offer a correction to something you said at the close of this evening's episode when you attributed Fortune Favors the Brave to Pliny the Elder. That is indeed, Professor Husky went on, what Pliny the Elder's nephew, the conveniently named Pliny the Younger, reported his uncle saying during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. However, he was probably quoting the playwright Terence. It's not as good a story as the whole Pliny thing, but we should give credit where credit is due. And if we are really sticking to that, see Virgil, who put the phrase into the mouth of the villain Turnus in the Aeneid. I always enjoy your show, he said. Professor Husky did add, by the way, that what Virgil actually said was audentis fortuna iuvat, which, since I failed Latin first quarter freshman year of college, that's actually true. Professor Husky translated for me as fortune favors those who act boldly. Now, whether they were buying crypto, I don't know. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context. A couple of quick data points for your edification heading into the weekend. Data from the Labor Department today. I know it's fun, right? I'm giving you these stats to go into your weekend. Anyway, Labor Department data today, saw this on Bloomberg, I ought to say, shows the unemployment rate in almost half of the states, 22 of them to be exact, is at or below 3%. The lowest, Minnesota, 1.8%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.